Okay, still more addition to alkenes. And this time we get into using other elements than the first row. But first, to complete that idea of the acid-catalyzed hydrolysis of acetals. Acetals, remember, these sort of double ethers where a carbon has two RO groups on it. So we saw that the first goal was to remove RO and replace it by OH in adding water, or replacing the ROs by water. So we were able to do that, remember, by using acid catalysis, this unusually stable cation where the unshared pair next door gets stabilized. So we can do a reaction like this, and we've got that one done. And what would you call that reaction as a class of reactions where we replace the OR by OH? Is that a mechanism that looks familiar to you? Yeah. Pardon me? It's an SN1 reaction, right? The OH is normally not a good leaving group, but protonated, it's a good leaving group, especially when you get such a good cation. Okay, so that's an SN1 reaction. Okay. Now we want to remove the second RO and then also an H from the OH group. So we do the same trick again, protonate. Leaving group leaves, get a stable cation. Okay, now all we do is remove a proton, and we've got the carbon-oxygen double bond. So a ketal is equivalent to a carbonyl group. You can get back and forth with acid. Okay, incidentally, what do you call this second reaction? The first one was SN1, yeah? That's E1, right. Okay, so these are reactions that are just review, really, but it's a very important process because it takes things that are ethers and therefore not so reactive, right, into carbonyl compounds, which are some of the most favorite reactive compounds. It's one of the best functional groups for being reactive. So you can protect a carbonyl group by having it be this double ether, the ketal, and then treat it with acid and water, and it becomes the carbonyl group again. Okay, so the overall transformation is to go back and forth between water and an acetal and a carbonyl group plus two alcohols. So what we could think of it here is water comes in and cleaves the acetal apart to give carbonyl and two alcohols. But notice the ozonide, which is how we got into this, is a double acetal because the carbon on the left is a double ether and the carbon on the right is a double ether. Right? So if we treat this with water twice, we can do the trick on the right and also do it on the left. Right? So this thing, which is, you remember what that ozonide came from? That five-membered ring with two O's on the bottom, on the top, and one on the bottom? Where it originally came from? What did we react with what to get that, Don?
Ozone.
It was ozone and an alkene, remember? So now the alkene, which was a carbon-carbon double bond, has been pulled apart, and each partner has been replaced by an oxygen. So you cleaved a carbon-carbon double bond to make two carbon-oxygen double bonds. Okay, so that's it's still used very much as a reaction, but it was in the old days when they didn't have spectroscopic tools for finding out the structure of molecules. This was a very handy one where you could take a compound that was an alkene and you didn't know where the double bond was in the molecule. You could cleave it into two carbonyls, identify those two, and then from the two parts you knew where the double bond was originally. So anyhow, we can get that. Now, if you want to use this for preparative purposes to get two carbonyl compounds, it's important to notice that one of the byproducts is hydrogen peroxide. Right? Not just water, but hydrogen peroxide in this, the case of this particular kind of ether. Okay, and hydrogen peroxide oxidizes aldehydes to carboxylic acids. So if you're using this in order to prepare these two things, and one of them that you want happens to be an aldehyde, then you're in trouble because the products will react with it. So what can you do? Well, you can add a reducing agent like a sulfide or zinc to destroy the hydrogen peroxide as it gets made so it won't react with the aldehyde. We already saw a sulfur react with a peroxide before. Remember that was in making Nexium? That was the thing putting the oxygen on with the peroxide. So here are two examples from the book giving relatively high yields, right? One of them involves using a sulfide to get rid of it so you can protect this aldehyde here. And the other one uses zinc. In that case, you didn't really need it because the compound that you almost certainly wanted was this one, which was not an aldehyde, it was a ketone, and that doesn't react with hydrogen peroxide easily. The other one, the aldehyde that you might wanted to have protected, was formaldehyde, which is unlikely to be the thing you are aiming for with this complicated molecule. Or, alternatively, you could just go with the flow, add more hydrogen peroxide so all your stuff gets oxidized, so there's enough there to be sure it gets oxidized. And then you can get a good yield of the carboxylic acid. So in the first case here, you would cleave this and make a carbonyl here and a carbonyl here. This one would be an aldehyde, this one would be an aldehyde. By having enough hydrogen peroxide, both of them are carboxylic acids, or the same deal here, where you get an aldehyde here and an aldehyde here, but with enough hydrogen peroxide, those are carboxylic acids, 85% yield. Okay, so that's just a practical point. Now, how does this happen? How is it that hydrogen peroxide reacts with an aldehyde? Who's got an idea on how these can begin to react? Renchi, what do you say? Where do we have a HOMO and LUMO that can do the trick here for us? Right, the O minus and the LUMO? Five star. Okay, so we'll start in here and do that. Okay, that's going to give us this. Now, who's got an idea for a subsequent reaction with a HOMO and LUMO?
The HOMO is O.
Yeah, the O minus.
The sigma star.
Sigma star. Okay, so this looks great. We're going to be able to do that. Now, hydroxide's not a very good leaving group. Okay, but the OO bond is not a very stable bond. So even though hydroxide wouldn't leave normally from carbon, it's easy to leave from here, so that's fine. But how about the product that you would get in this case? Sharif, what do you think of your product? Well, your hydroxide is one product. What's the other product?
You have a double bond.
Not a double bond. These electrons are going between this oxygen and this oxygen.
Oh, so you get another OO bond.
You get a new OO bond. That's not so great either, and it's really not so great. Why?
Because there's strain.
Yeah, strain. It's a three-membered ring, so that doesn't look so good. Okay, so it looked obvious, but now there's a fancy way to do it, which is to use those electrons to go like this. So these electrons go in to make a double bond. The hydrogen, with its electrons, shifts. It's a hydride that shifts, not a proton, right? But the hydrogen, with a pair of electrons, shifts here and attacks the OO bond so that hydroxide leaves, right? So it's a hydride shift, right? And we've seen a thing very like that before. Remember in the hydroboration oxidation, where we first got this intermediate when we treated the borane, Br3, with hydrogen peroxide, right? And now this R with its minus, with its electrons, right? The methide, say, if it were a methyl group, shifts, and this happens. So it's exactly the same kind of reaction, except that the electrons get supplied from here rather than here. Okay, so that happens. Sometimes you draw, to be fancy, you draw a loop in an arrow to show that there's been a rearrangement. Right here, this group shifting over. Okay, so now you have this carboxylic acid and hydroxide, but of course this is an acid, this is a base, so now you have a very exothermic reaction to follow where the proton gets transferred, right? So that's when you treat an aldehyde with hydrogen peroxide, you get a carboxylic acid, right? That's why in that ozonization process, you had to worry about whether you had hydrogen peroxide in there or not. Okay, now, just for fun, this is a base catalyzed reaction, right? Because we used this O minus. right? Try drawing an analogous reaction where you start with hydrogen peroxide and use acid as a catalyst, and you'll see that you can do it either way. So you can't get around it by changing the pH. Okay, so that's a problem for you. Again, would you like me to have you hand these problems in to make sure that you do them? Or do you think that's sort of Mickey Mouse? You have the problem, do it. If you have trouble doing it, talk about it in the discussion groups. I think that's just as good. Okay, now, nucleophilic addition to we've been talking about the carbon-carbon double bond. But in fact, and it's generally said to be electrophilic, right? It's something with a low LUMO that attacks the carbon-carbon double bond. But what we've just been talking about in the last lecture or so is that it's not just electrophilic. There's also often a second pair of electrons that's involved that's nucleophilic. And the same thing is true in what we normally talk about nucleophilic addition to carbonyls, the thing we just talked about in the last slide, for example. Often, there's also a LUMO that's participating as well as the HOMO of the nucleophile, right? The nucleophile often has a LUMO too. So it's not that different often between carbon-carbon double bonds and carbon-oxygen double bonds, even though different names are assigned to them. For example, and that's what I say here, the nucleophilic addition of methyl lithium. So methyl lithium has a high HOMO, right, in the carbon-lithium bond to a carbonyl group, is formally quite different from the additions of electrophiles to alkenes, right, something with a low LUMO. But the following transition state analysis shows a mechanistic similarity. So here's the transition state for methyl lithium adding to a carbon-oxygen double bond. Now, in simple terms, what you'd think of is that you have a high HOMO, because lithium is not very electronegative, right? So this pair of electrons is unusually high. So you'd think you'd have the high HOMO, sort of like a carbon anion, attacking the carbonyl carbon pi star, right? We've talked about that a lot. But in fact, the other thing happens too, and both bonds are being made at the same time, because the vacant orbital on lithium is also interacting with the high HOMO here. Now, so that in fact you're making two bonds at once. So there's the thing moving in the transition state to go toward lithium O carbon carbon. So you normally we think of forming this bond when you attack a carbonyl. But in fact, this is an important part of it as well, often. Okay, and here we see it. There's the HOMO, right, which is the pair of electrons, the sigma electrons and the carbon-lithium bond, right? And those, of course, interact with the pi star, and that's what we usually think about. But here, the LUMO, or in fact the LUMO plus 2 at the transition state, is this p orbital on lithium, which comes down and overlaps this part of the HOMO. So you're forming both those at once. Okay, now, most of the things we've been talking about are first row elements, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, hydrogen, so on. But as Professor Siegel said, there's important reactions of alkenes that involve other kinds of elements further down the periodic table, namely metals. So this thing involving manganese, permanganate, or this one involving palladium as a catalyst. So now we're going to look a little bit at those reactions of alkenes. So first, osmium tetroxide and the permanganate anion. So it's a tetrahedral metal with four oxygens on it. If it's osmium, this is OSO4, a neutral compound. If it's manganese, then this is an anion, the permanganate anion. Right, so here's that set of metal with four oxygens, and here's the alkene we want to attack. Now, here's the HOMO of the oxide, and you see it's really well set up to do what, this HOMO? Can you see what it's going to mix with of the alkene? Pi star LUMO. Right, so that's great. That's going to stabilize those electrons. And at the same time, this is the LUMO of the osmium tetroxide or the permanganate. And now you see this is well set up to mix with the HOMO. So as in these previous cases, there are two pairs of electrons going to be stabilized. We're going to make two bonds between this, say, osmium tetroxide and the alkene. So for example, this is from the book. They draw three arrows here like this. You know, I would draw this arrow different. How would I draw it differently, this arrow? How would I hope you would draw it differently? Yeah. Right, it forms the new bond. So it actually goes to between the carbon and the oxygen, not onto the oxygen. Everybody see? Of course, you could have a completely different scheme where you say these curved arrows mean what the electron pair is going to be shared with. But I think it's clearer to show that it's going to be between two things rather than to say it's going on to something. Okay, so I would draw it like this and like that and like this ending up here. But at any rate, it forms this five-membered ring, which is called an osmate ester. Now, notice this is the osmium analog of an acetal. If that had been carbon, this would be a double ether. Everybody see what I'm saying? And we just talked about that kind of thing, that you can cleave these bonds with water, right? Get the alcohol away, or two alcohols away, and put an oxygen on there. So that you can imagine, and in fact it happens, that you can treat this thing with water and get a diol, OHOH, and a new osmium-oxygen double bond here, just the same way you do with a normal carbon-based ketal. Okay? And it's also possible to add water to this, so you could have it be O2OSOH taken twice. Okay, so that means that you have the possibility of doing a reaction with this, like this. You can treat this double bond with osmium tetroxide, get this osmate ester, and it can be isolated in 96% yield. But then if you treat it with water and a reducing agent to get rid of the OSO3, then you get two OH groups added on here. That is, this ketal gets converted into two OH groups, right? And notice they're cis to one another. They're on the same face of the molecule because they came in this way, adding both bonds at once. Okay. Now, you could indeed do that. In fact, I trust, although no reference was given, that these are real experimental numbers. But there are difficulties. One is that osmium tetroxide is very poisonous. And the other is it's fabulously expensive. Osmium is a very rare element. So much better than doing the reaction this way, where in the second step you put in something that's going to destroy the oxidizing power of this thing. You use it as a catalyst, just a tiny amount, and add an oxidant that will take this osmium this reduced compound and make it back into osmium tetroxide again. That is, take, say, this stuff and put another oxygen back on it, up to here. Right? So now this happens all at once. You have water there all together, and the question is only what oxidizing agent you use. In 1936, a guy at MIT figured out how to use hydrogen peroxide for that, so as to use osmium tetroxide catalytically. The nice thing about osmium tetroxide is this is a very easy, clean reaction. Right? Clean except the fact that it's so poisonous. Okay, but then in 1976, workers at Upjohn Pharmaceutical Company developed a technique of using this NO bond as the source of the oxygen that'll put another O on here and take it back to osmium tetroxide. And that became the standard way of doing it. And in fact, the guy who was director of research at Upjohn, just parenthetically, is the guy whose picture is right here. Right, the Heil, whose estate gave the money to redo this room a while back, was a Yale undergraduate. His father had a drugstore over on Orange Street, right? But he went to Yale and became a good chemist and was the director of research at Upjohn. So this was the Upjohn method. But there are other oxidizing agents that could be used as well. But another really important contribution was Professor Sharpless, who we talked about last semester, in 1988, tried this with an amine holding on to the osmium as well. A chiral amine. What do you think the point of doing that was? Why would Sharpless have wanted to use a chiral amine and make this reaction still more complicated? Any ideas what you might be able to do with if you had a chiral amine? And that which came from nature, so it's just one hand. Yeah. Right, now you get these new alcohols you get have a chiral center here and a chiral center here. And you can control which face of the alkene it comes on in a case where it's chiral. For example, if this were had R's like that, then you'd get different chirality here if you attacked from the top and the bottom. And it's different if you have a chiral ligand. In fact, this room was one of the first places that Professor Sharpless talked about that when he gave a seminar here. I don't know, well, in 1988, I guess, or maybe 1987. And he actually showed us the reaction on the desk here. He actually mixed things and did it. And he spilled osmium on the thing, which is very poisonous stuff. He's a real wild guy. But at any rate, that was a... Now, so that's with osmium. Now, much cheaper is permanganate, and it can do exactly the same thing, which doesn't surprise you, having seen that their orbitals are the same. But that one is that one here for the potassium permanganate gives here an 85% yield of, again, these two oxygens are added from the same face of the double bond. It's a syn addition. Okay. Now, metals are even more important in catalytic hydrogenation. This was an oxidation we just talked about, but here's a reduction where you put hydrogen in. Now, suppose we wanted to do a homo-lumo reaction, adding H2 to a carbon double bond to an alkene to get the alkane. Now, this is a very exothermic reaction. Professor Siegel went through that, talking about the bond strength. So it's way downhill, but it's also fabulously slow. You can mix these hydrogen gas with an alkene and wait forever and nothing happens. And the reason, of course, is that the orbitals are wrong. What's going on here? Yeah, if you look at the orbitals you'd want to mix sigma star lumo with the pi homo, they have the wrong symmetry. They're orthogonal, and the same here. What you'd want is to mix these, but now of course you're mixing homo with homo and lumo with lumo, and that's not a way to make any money. Okay, so the reaction doesn't work. Okay, but it does work if you have a catalyst, a metal like a platinum or palladium. And usually such reactions usually are, or often at least, are heterogeneous. That means that that the metal is in the form of a solid. So the reaction's happening at the surface of the metal. So you don't want to put in a chunk of metal which has very little surface. You want it to be very, very finely divided to have the maximum amount of surface of this expensive stuff. So you usually support it on something else, like here on charcoal, so that there are little bits of the metal all over the surface of the charcoal, and they have access then to the reagents. So with palladium, for example, it works fine. So now let's look at the orbitals. Now, the neat thing about these metals is that they have orbitals for almost any purpose you can imagine. So palladium has 10 4D, so 5D orbitals occupied, and fairly low-lying 5S and 5P orbitals, right? Okay, so suppose we want to mix with the homo pi of the ethylene or the lumo pi star, and what we want to do is see what we got in the way of palladium. So we have the 4D orbital. That doesn't look good for pi star, although it would be okay for pi. That looks bad. That looks bad. That looks bad. Ah, now we got one. right? So you can almost always find a high HOMO because all these d orbitals are the same energy, right? They're all the high HOMO. So we got one that'll mix with pi star. And in fact, if you put the two things, bring the two things together, that turns out to be in a complex between palladium and ethylene. This is the HOMO minus 4. Now, if you really look at this, it's not exactly that. It's 40% of that 4DXY. And 47% of it is actually, at this stage, CH bonds going out here. But there's a little bit of that pi star orbital still in it. At the transition state, before you formed the complex, there was a lot more. So those are the orbitals that come together to give this. So that's fine. We got something in the palladium that can do the trick. Now, how about mixing with pi? Well, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad, that's good. Okay? But that was a HOMO. The unoccupied, so you want an unoccupied orbital to do that. Now the 5P here is good for doing that, or the 5S. So when you bring these, when you form another bond in the thing, you get this, and that's the HOMO of the complex. So you see it was made from a hybrid orbital on palladium here that's overlapping with pi star. And what that orbital is mostly that 4DZ squared. Right, but a little bit of these of this sp hybrid here that was set up to do that, and 67% of the pi. So you have so much flexibility with metals that you can almost always find a way to do these tricks. Okay, so you can form two bonds at once by those two mixings and make a three-membered ring. Okay, so let's look at the energies that are involved here. So here's hydrogen gas and palladium, right? And that's our reference energy. That's where we're going to start on this scale. And this is done with a crummy calculation. I'll show you the results of a somewhat better calculation on the next slide. Okay, so now here are different stages you can go through. The hydrogen can approach the palladium and just be H2 sort of close to the palladium. And that's lower in energy. It's down here. And then you can start bringing the hydrogen in still closer and lengthening the difference, the distance a little bit between the hydrogens, right? So they get more attached. And then you go through a transition state. Let me draw the curve here. Then you go through a transition state where the hydrogens are getting apart from one another. And now they're quite far apart from one another at this geometry, okay? Now it's not as stable here as it is there. Right, this was the lowest energy, at least according to this crummy calculation. But this hydride is able to move to the next palladium in a piece of solid palladium metal. So this can move to the next one and the next one and the next one with its electrons. So it's the hydride can shift. So these move and dissolve. And when you have that possibility, there are ever so many different ways of putting these two hydrogens in there. So even though it's uphill a little bit in energy, it's downhill in free energy because of the entropy that's involved with all the different ways of moving the hydride around. Okay, so it's possible to dissociate H2 on the surface of palladium. Right? Now here's a better, I trust it's a better calculation than the one I did. I didn't actually look into the details of what all these various letters mean. But the more letters, presumably, the more trouble they took to do the calculation. At any rate, this was published in Journal of Physical Chemistry in 2004. So here's H2 getting close to palladium, then getting still closer, and the bond beginning to stretch, and finally breaking the bond. And here are the energies they calculated for these different stages in that one. Okay, and then they also happen to have it for carbon with hydrogen attaching and getting methyl and hydrogen attached to the palladium. Okay, so people can do these kind of calculations. Now, the names that are associated with this are oxidative insertion. It said that palladium undergoes oxidative insertion, or that alkene undergoes oxidative insertion with the palladium. So what that means is these two bonds forming at once, and you get that three-membered ring. Okay? And you can have the reverse of it, which is called reductive elimination. So if you have the alkene on there to form this three-membered ring, then it can come off again. And that's so oxidative insertion, and the reverse is reductive elimination. Now you can do this, here we did it with a pi orbital, you can do it with sigma too. So with H2, as we were just discussing, you can do the same thing and get two H's attached to the palladium, and you can do reductive elimination and come back again. So the metal has this flexibility of orbitals that allows it to fiddle with both pi and sigma orbitals. So we could imagine having the hydrogen come onto the surface of a solid chunk of palladium here and attached to a palladium, but then the hydrogen, this hydrogen could move away. Okay, a hydride could shift, and now we got palladium attached to hydrogen, but it's still got a lot of orbitals. Right? So now we can do this thing and bring alkene in and do the oxidative insertion there and get this intermediate. Now, of course, we could reverse it and do the reductive elimination and come back again. There's no great excitement there. But instead of doing that, we could do the reverse of this reaction to make a new sigma bond. Remember, this was here we had broken a sigma bond, but now we can remake the sigma bond and come back. So we can do that trick here. And if we do that, we make this new CH bond, right? And now we can bring back the hydride that's swimming around elsewhere on the metal. And can you guess what I'm going to do next? Anybody got an idea? Kathy? Pardon me? Right, you do the same thing as this using these two bonds. And now look what's happened. Right? We've added H2 to the alkene. Right? So this is how the metal can act as a catalyst to add H2 to alkene. What a metal essentially does is provide orbitals of the proper symmetry so that you don't have HOMOs trying to mix with HOMOs and LUMOs with LUMOs. So in this way then, the palladium addition to make the two bonds to the alkene originally happened at the same time. So they come from the same face of the double bond. Right? And then each hydrogen replaces palladium here. First one and then the other. So that means that the addition to the alkene is from a single face of the alkene. So if we had two R groups coming out at us here, they're coming out at us here, they're coming out at us here, they're coming out at us here. The two hydrogens came in from the same face of the double bond. So it's syn addition. Now that's the standard story, and the book gives a good example of this in figure 10.3, where you have a ring, so you can tell easily whether two hydrogens came in from the same face. Here they used deuterium, although it wasn't necessary to use deuterium to show this. You could have shown it with hydrogen. But the isomer formed here is 94.5% cis, the methyls on the same side. The case you might want to use deuterium is if the things here were only hydrogen, and then you couldn't tell, right? And you'd want to use deuterium. But at any rate, the book has this example, and it certainly supports the idea that the addition comes from the same face of the double bond. That's a syn addition. But it's not always true. This is from the textbook last year. And notice they say that here's a H2 and palladium catalyst, and it's a syn addition, and you get the racemate. And from the cis isomer here, you get the meso compound. But notice several things about this when you're reading a textbook. No yields are specified in this, and no references are given, right? So you just have to go on just have to buy that this is what it is. And maybe it's true. But notice it says here most alkenes. It doesn't say it always happens that way. So if you look at a next generation kind of textbook, the kind that's used in a more advanced course on synthetic organic chemistry, then you look at this reaction. Here's a double bond. You have palladium and hydrogen. in acetic acid, and this is the product. Which is the sin product, the one where they got added on the same face? What? Right, 10% sin addition, 90% is anti-addition. Now, how the heck did this happen? Right? Now, fortunately, in this more advanced book, you have a reference. So you can look at reference 42, and you have lots of different examples, right? And you can go and look at the original literature and see what they actually found. So one thing that was found early, 1948, and notice it's by Barton. Do you remember the name Barton from last semester? I mean, it was in passing. I wouldn't really expect you to. But he's the guy that had the idea of chair cyclohexane and different reactivities for axial and equatorial, and drew the funny cyclohexane where the polar bonds were pointing the wrong way. Anyhow, this is at about the same time, and they were studying steroids like this. And notice what he did here. The rearrangement of gamma spinosteinyl acetate. So this is spinosteinyl. This is spinosteinol when this is an H, and spinosteinyl acetate when this is an acetyl group. Right? Now, he starts with this double bond, and he goes from the gamma isomer to the alpha isomer. Presumably what he wanted to do was add two hydrogens on here. But in fact what happened when he treated it with a platinum catalyst and hydrogen for 6 hours, he got this. It moved the double bond instead of getting rid of it. Right? So this suggests that catalytic hydrogenation can be a little bit more complicated than we gave it credit for. Okay, so it isomerized it. Now, how did it isomerize it? And he got 80% actually of this stuff. So here's the reaction we wanted to happen, right? To add hydrogen. But suppose there were another carbon next door on this alkene, right? So that's all the way. But suppose we get to this stage here, and there's an H on that carbon, right? Then we come down here, and you see that that's symmetrical, okay? An H on either carbon. So now you could imagine this reversing, going back this way, to happen not only with this hydrogen, which is the one that was originally put on, but you could take off this hydrogen and then take the alkene off, and now you have the double bond in the next adjacent position, right? So you get an isomerization instead of completing the hydrogenation. So the alkene was isomerized. Now, in fact, what I had blacked out here before was that happens in this case. Whereas you started with this, that product, and you would expect it to hydrogenate to get the syn, the hydrogens on the same face, if it moved the double bond out to here, but this hydrogen has already been added, then that second hydrogen, or the relevant hydrogen, the one that adds here, when this is the pair being added, could come in just as easily from the opposite face and give the more stable compound. Right? So, that looks like the answer, and that's what this book said the answer was. Right? But if you look at the actual reference, you can see that it's confusing, and I don't really understand it. The relevant cycloalkenes that they were dealing with are these two, 7 and 8. This is 7, right? So if they started with 7, they said that if they did complete hydrogenation, they got 90% of this isomer, and that's the result that's given here, okay, 90%. If they did just a little bit, partial hydrogenation, then they found that the alkene that was left was 100% this. They didn't have any of that. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. You could say that this stuff reacts very quickly, more quickly than this one. So you convert, so indeed you do the isomerization, convert this to this, but this one reacts very quickly to give this compound. This one reacts only slowly to give this compound. Right, so you get mostly this stuff. Nothing wrong with that. What's confusing is what happened when they started with pure 8. So they start with pure 8. And now, as you expect, they get mostly this product, right? This product here. But the thing that's not explained here, and maybe there's nothing really to explain, maybe their numbers just aren't that good, right? But this says it gives less of this product when you start with this being pure than if you start with this stuff. And that doesn't make any sense to me. So I think there's more here than meets the eye. And the reason I went into this is not because I think this is particularly important, but to show you the importance of being able to trace back these things that they tell you as gospel in the book, that it's all trans or something like that, and see what really happened. And often it's much more complicated, or there are more interesting things that what could be studied. This one I don't think has ever been studied any further than that. Hey, but anyhow, it seems to me still a puzzle that you don't get more of this stuff if you start with pure this stuff than if you start with that. Now, another important metal catalyzed reaction is one involving what's called a Grubbs catalyst, and it has a bunch of other stuff on the ruthenium that's important but that we're not going to talk about. And for this he shared the Nobel Prize in 2005. So you have a carbon double bonded to the ruthenium. You bring an alkene up, right? Do our trick. And now do this kind of thing when this was a double bond instead of a single bond. Right? So now we get this metallocycle, a four-membered ring, one of the members being ruthenium. Now, can you see what might happen here? This could reverse, of course, and go back to the starting material. What else could happen other than going back to the starting material? Yeah, Matt? Pardon me? It could do what?
It could become a three-membered ring.
It could become a three-membered ring. Well, here's a three-membered ring here. Yeah, this reverses. It becomes a three. Oh, you mean this carbon-carbon-carbon three-membered ring. I don't know that that happens. I mean, it's not implausible that it would happen. Let's see. Is that... that's exactly. We could shift these up to here and this onto here, and that would become a three-membered ring. And here's where lore comes in. That's not what happens. Okay, but there's something else interesting that can happen here. Yeah. Kevin? Right. This is symmetrical. So here we went back and formed the three-membered ring with the blue carbon. We can form the three-membered ring with the purple carbon and reverse that. And now, what have we affected here? What's the upshot of having done this reaction? We changed partners between double-bonded carbons, right? And we have as a product here the same as the starting material, except for which carbon is involved, right? So this could do it again. So we can mix up alkenes. We can start with a certain substituents here and here on an alkene, but mix them up if we put two alkenes in there. Okay, and one of the neat... this, incidentally, is Professor Ziegler, who teaches the... who last semester taught the other organic course. And this is on a trip to Japan when these schoolgirls thought it was... he's pretty tall. He's about this tall. Right? So they thought they wanted to get their picture taken with him. But another guy who's really tall is Professor Grubbs, the guy who got the Nobel Prize for this reaction. And they were together in Japan. So there they are, both looking very tall. And here they are with their host in Japan. I love that picture. I wanted to show it to you. Okay, so Grubbs is a tall guy. And in fact, his daughter went to Yale and was on the basketball team, right, and took Ziegler's course. So anyhow, there you go. Okay, so here's ring opening metathesis. So metathesis is this mixing up of double bonds. But Grubbs figured out a way to do polymerization. So you start with this alkene, and you bring in your reagent, and do the... right, you would form a four-membered ring here and break it apart, so now we have a double bond here and a double bond there to the ruthenium. Okay? But now you can do the same trick again, and you get a whole bunch of these in a row. So that's an interesting kind of macromolecule and is commercially useful. So that's ring opening metathesis, that's called. And that was part of the kind of thing that made him get the Nobel Prize. Now, we've looked at catalytic hydrogenation here, but there's a kind of polymerization called Ziegler-Natta polymerization, which is commercially very important, which is strongly analogous to this. So instead of palladium, it uses titanium. And almost all these things were originally discovered as sort of a witch's brew of just putting lots of different things in there and seeing what comes out. And that's what Siegel talked about, a lot of these things being discovered that way. But anyhow, the crucial thing is to have a titanium compound. Okay, and an alkene comes in and does this trick we've been talking about, just as above. But now we have an R group here, and we can put the R group on there. Okay, see the analogy. Okay, but now notice this is just titanium with a different R group on it, two carbons longer. Right, so it can come back and be the R group here. So you can add another two carbons and another two carbons and another two carbons and get a really long chain. So, for example, high-density polyethylene, which is number two on your recycling, is made to the tune of 25 million tons a year in 2004. And the tricks then are how you control it to get the length you want for the properties you desire. So high-density polyethylene typically has 800 to 8,000 ethylenes linked together in a chain. Right, or polypropylene has up to 10 to the fifth of these propylene groups linked onto one another. So 45 million tons of that. So what was it we said last time about the number of tons of ethylene oxide? I think it was about 20, I think, or 15 or 20 million tons. So these are even bigger. And this is used for lots of things like rope, underwear. It's what military, where they need to wick the perspiration out and stuff like that. Milk bottles, soft drink bottles, and so on. That's a lot of material, 45 million tons. But a neat thing about it with respect to its properties is that when you have a chain with these carbons on it, you can imagine a zigzag chain. Every other carbon has a methyl group. Now, it could have been messed up. It could have been a methyl group here, methyl group here, then a methyl group here, methyl group here. You could have put the alkenes in backwards and forwards. But with the Ziegler-Natta polymerization, they go in exactly. Every other carbon has it. And not only that, they all point the same way. If you have the zigzag going like this, at every carbon you could have the methyl going this way and the hydrogen back, or vice versa. But it's called isotactic. They're all the same. Methyl, 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 methyl. So that they pack together much better than things that would be random and give a lot of strength. Okay, oops, there was something else I meant to say there. I meant just to mention that it was isotactic. Okay, now, that contrasts with radical polymerization, which we'll talk about next time.